This podcast is brought to you by The Province.
The Province Sports Podcast.
Welcome to Province Sports Radio. I'm Paul Chapman, joined by Ed Willis on our semi-permanent, when we feel like it, when technology allows podcast.
And that's a catchy title. I think we can market
like it.
That.
We can maybe come up with an acronym.
That's good branding.
Well, we love branding here. So, Ed, let me revisit back to the start of the year. And though, even though the Canucks started this season with a victory, Louis Erickson scored a goal into his own net, and that seemed like the most Canuckian thing ever. But we did not know which turns this season would take so early.
Yeah, see, I scoffed when you brought that up at the time. And I thought, like, come on, what are the odds? Louis Erickson, okay, it's just one of those freak things. Still a 30-goal scorer, still has this magical chemistry with the Sedins. He's going to be fine. Like, I am astonished we're sitting here in the place we are, really just 3 weeks into their season, and they are at a crisis point already. I mean, I don't think anybody thought they were world beaters this year. I think everybody picked them, you know, like anywhere from 9th to 12th in the West, and that seemed reasonable, but they have just fallen off a cliff. And now the big question is, how do they respond? Is there any way they can reverse this, or are we going to start seeing some seismic changes in the organization again?
It is. There's some comedy in this, no doubt, with being shut out so often for the last five games. But, you know, I saw some of this debate, and it's so funny when you're talking about skilled athletes. Like, really, we're talking about top-end, world-class, elite athletes, that confidence would play so much in it. I saw the explanations out of Montreal, Ed, 42 shots. Well, Carey Price stood on his head, this, that, and the other. But I've seen this team do this before. When they so desperately need a goal, you can have 100 shots. If they're not quality shots and they're not taken with skill, and you're just throwing stuff up at the net and hoping that someone's maybe going to get a so-called greasy one, to use the hockey parlance, you know, obviously a good goalie is going to collect a whole bunch of those. What is it happening here? Is it a system? Is it a lack of skill? Or is it, frankly, confidence?
Well, you say, here's the thing, and I'm gonna give a stab at this. They've implemented this defense first system. You know, clearly that is priority. Well, to score goals, you have to cheat. Unless you are such a supreme offensive talent, you can create on your own. And the Canucks don't have those guys anymore. The Sedins in their prime were. They're not in their prime anymore. So you've got to change. You've got to play a little looser. You've got to cheat on the offensive end. You've got to release a little earlier. You've got to look for the hole maybe when you don't have possession of the puck. And I think it's the same thing in soccer, is it not? I mean, you can't rely on systems to produce your goal. There's got to be this element of creativity, and you have to take risks and chances, which they are loath to do. And I will also say this, I have never seen a great team develop out of a defensive system going back to New Jersey, and New Jersey had a Hall of Fame goalie and two Hall of Fame defensemen and a coach who just loved that style. Every other team I've seen has developed their own, have played a fast, up-tempo game, and, you know, maybe they modify it, but that's where it has to start. And they have to find a way to unleash the young talent they have and find out if they are actual different makers or if they're just really, you know, average NHL players. And if that's the case, but they have to find out. They can't try and mask it with this, like, system, which is only getting them to a place where they can lose games 2-1, 1-0, 2-1.
I want to touch on something that you raised with the Sedins, and certainly you're absolutely right. They're not the elite players they were, but are they not obviously part of the problem here? You would hope that within four games where you're shut out, that they're still on your top line, that they could conjure up a goal.
No, absolutely. They are. And I would still argue part of the problem is they're not elite. The other part of the problem is there's nobody to take the pressure off them. And to me, the key to the thing is Bo Horvat. You've got to put him in offensive situations. You've got to turn him loose and find out if he is that 55 to 60 point centerman. And then all of a sudden, the thing with the Sedins isn't quite as dramatic. You're not counting on them as much. I think it's pretty clear what they are now. Still reasonably good offensive players who on a given night can produce some offense. They just can't do it on a night in, night out basis. So what do you do from there? Then you look for the rest of your lineup.
So this is the dilemma that we've talked about the Canucks being in, that you know, the Sedins really should be second liners at this point, but they have to be first liners because your only options are really third liners with this, let alone bumping them down. But let me ask you this, because this was a thought for me from the start of the season. You know, Jake Virtanen, now we're in the business, so I know that you can't believe, you know, half of the hyperbole, or more like 80% of the hyperbole that's thrown at you. But these comparisons from the Sedins, that reminds me of Bertuzzi, who we used to play with, et cetera, et cetera. You know, is his attitude right? Should he be sent to Utica? Everything else. What better place for him to develop than playing with the Sedins? And yet, I know this coach now doesn't just need a win to save his job. He probably needs a goal or two. Is that where this organization is at odds?
I think maybe the test case, and it might even be too late for that, but I really believe the test case for Willie Desjardins as a head coach is what he's going to do with Jake Virtanen. This is an elite talent. This is the sixth player taken overall in the draft, ahead of some guys who are leap years ahead of him. Everybody can see he has all the raw tools, so they've got to put him in. And it just isn't enough to say, you know, we're going to put you on the fourth line. You have to work for your ice time, kid. It just doesn't work that way. The onus is on the organization as much or even more so than Virtanen. But you've got this asset and you've got to turn him into a difference maker, into an impact player. And if they don't, like if he turns out to be a bust, because that's going to set this whole rebuilding thing back.
Well, I mean,
three, 4 years.
Absolutely. But certainly there's attitude. And then there's, you know.
Oh, he's not the perfect. Kid. Absolutely. Yeah, yeah. You know, I see all the warts. Yeah.
Oh, no. But having said that, when some players come into the NHL and you wonder where it is right away. You wonder what scouts saw to pick them sixth overall. I would argue that last year we already saw enough to know that this kid definitely has what it takes to be a star. Obviously, that's on him. A lot of it's on the development of the organization. But I want to touch again on something that you said, which is very sort. I don't want to say it's just germane to hockey coaches. You see it with some football coaches as well. But this idea that Bo Horvat, that Jake Virtanen have to start on the fourth line and earn their first line. We saw that conversation with Zach Cassian. The best fit maybe on the first line, playing with two very offensively skilled and players who have a ton of leadership. But no, you've got to earn your minutes. That's a tough dilemma for a coach here, isn't it? Especially a coach who has to win. But as you said.
Yeah, I think it also depends on where your team is in its cycle. And, you know, obviously, if you've got a winning team, then you don't put a kid up in your top six, give him that spot. But look where the Canucks are. What could it hurt to try him 3-4 games with the Sedins, or in a situation where he's playing 18 minutes, where he's on first unit power play? And the same thing goes with Horvat. I mean, you know, turn him loose. See what you've really got with this, because clearly what they're doing now isn't working. And it's not like a switch is going to flip and Brandon Sutter is what he is. I think the Sedins are what they are. You can look up and down that lineup and pretty well identify the players who are 25 older, what they are and what they're going to bring. So they have to find out, you know, this group coming up from behind them, and they have to accelerate their development somehow. And in my opinion, that's force feeding them into situations where they're playing future roles.
Either there's one person who's being very vocal inside the Canucks organization, or there are a lot of parrots around town, but I've been hearing increasingly people claim that they've been told that Willie may not survive the road trip.
Yeah.
How foolish is this, or is it smart in your case? I know at some point you maybe have to change something, but coming into this season to stay with Willie Desjardins, what was your hope? Like, honestly, what was your hope, and why deviate from the plan? And this is something you talked about a lot last year, Ed, when we did this, is that the organization seemed to have a blueprint. They knew what they were doing. And now you're starting to see, are they deviating from that a little bit?
Well, yeah. So if you're going to get rid of him, why wouldn't you do it in the off season? Why are you doing it like a month into this season and everything? And that's another part of our story here. And I've been giving this a lot of thought, and it has something to do with an incident I found myself in the middle of, but this organization it seems to me ever since Pat Quinn was drummed out has just lurched from one calamity to another one. And it, there is no kind of emotional stability. There is no kind of mature, kind of well thought out reasoning. They just kind of lash out and at whatever problem or whatever perceived enemy comes across. And this is no way to build a franchise. And if it was one or two isolated cases, maybe you'd dismiss it. But it's over and over and over again. Whether it's Brian Burke, you know, railing against, you know, the scumbags and maggots in the media, or whether it's the owner phoning this paper trying to get people removed from beats, whether it's Mike Gillis doing his thing. I think there's a real underpinning of emotional instability in this organization. And now it looks like we're right back into it. I am told, and take this for what it's worth, Trevor Linden went to bat for Desjardins, and he kind of, ownership wanted to make the coaching change in the off season. Trevor used whatever capital he had to go to bat for Willie, and they said, okay, fine. So now they get rid of him, and where are we again? We're kind of in this, you know, weird limbo state where they're rebuilding, but not, but trying to be competitive, but they are, and it's just going to be a mess. What is the answer? And I'm going to backtrack because I'm not sure what the answer is. I just know what I've seen ever since I arrived in Vancouver, and it does not reflect well on this organization.
Speaking of not reflecting well, then if Trevor Linden goes to ownership and they want to make a change at the coach and he talks them into it, and you're at this point this quickly in the season, how rough is that for Trevor Linden's future, or do you believe that he really is still Mr. Canuck in the eyes of the owners?
Well, I think he is because he's the president. I think if he was the GM, it might be a little different. But then, where do the sights get trained next? Now you've got Benning all of a sudden who's sitting there who's passed on. I mean, look, we can go through the list. Everybody out there who's listening to this is probably aware of the misjudgments and mistakes that have been made on Benning's level. And if this ownership group has demonstrated anything, it's demonstrated it has an itchy trigger finger and not much patience for losing. So, I don't know. I mean, are we going to be sitting here at the end of the year looking at another new head coach and another new general manager? You have to admit it's within the realm of possibility, right? It's not
I would
like
say
that.
It's likely unless something changes,
anybody.
Right?
That wouldn't shock anybody. And then where are we? We're back into this, narrative of, knee jerk reactions and not sort of, well thought out plan. And I really thought they did. I thought when they brought Benning in and they brought Linden in, I thought, okay, this is it. They're going to build through the draft. They're going to have success that way. Now,
Well, okay, so what is it?
Anything is possible.
What does it say that the most, you talk about whether the coaching change and everything else. I had talked about a plan and a blueprint. The team cannot score goals. They could not score goals last year.
Yep.
They traded away one of their better offensive prospects in Jared McCann for Eric Goodbranson. I like Goodbranson. I actually think that's a good deal. I'm not necessarily discounting analytics, but a 6'4" tough defenseman, mm-hmm. got a bit of a mean streak, kids decent with the puck, and not the worst skater in the world. I think those are probably more rare than another offensive prospect. That doesn't change the fact that this team cannot score goals, and they traded away. Whether Hunter Shinkaruk ever makes it properly in the NHL, whether Jared McCann ever fully makes it in the NHL, the guys they drafted to be offensive threats have been moved out of town at the sake of defense, and now this team can't score goals. Is that a poor confluence of coincidences, Ed, or is this a major miscalculation on their part when you look at the organization as a whole?
Well, it's a little bit of both, but I would, I'd argue it this way. I mean, for the most part, the players they brought in were supposed to be young offensive players. That's Berchi, that's Granlund, and they were supposed to be a little further along in their development than some of the players that they got rid of. So I don't think it's like they deviated completely away from this, we're going to build towards skill and offense. The guys they brought in, they just don't seem to be able to do it at the NHL level. I think Berchi is just like a huge, huge problem for this organization. I mean, they had to have been penciling him in for 18 to 20 goals, which based on what he did last year seemed to be realistic. I mean, he scored 15 basically in the last 60 games of the season on a team that couldn't score. And he seemed to have some chemistry with Horvat. And now he's sitting here with no goals. I mean, there's an element of this which kind
but
of surpasses
no
all reason. No, well, that's right. Like, there's an element of this that which surpasses all reasoning. you could see guys slumping, but can you see Louis Erickson with no goals after 10 games? Berchi with no goals after 10 games? The defense collectively, I'm not sure what they have, but if they have more than three goals in the whole group, that's all they have. And I don't even think they have that now that I think of it. I can remember Edler scoring a goal, and I think Ben Hutton has one. Does Ben Hutton have one?
Yeah. Good question.
No,
Was that this year or last year?
Yeah, well, but it is, it's crazy. It really is. So, you know, and it just seems when you're confronting a problem of this magnitude, it just doesn't seem like there's any way out. And that's where the Canucks are right
now. You referenced earlier the Pat Quinn issue. And I remember when it came apart for Pat Quinn, hindsight afterwards, he said that the sea change for him was he had built this offensive team with McGillney bringing in to supplement Bure. It was a philosophy that they were going to be fast. They were going to be skilled. They were going to be entertaining. And then the NHL took a left turn. And right. that's, again, referenced the Devils era that you talked about. The rest of the league does seem to be looking at maybe whether it's not necessarily rules, but style perhaps being a little more offensive. And then as you bring up, this team is built for defense first. Don't take risks. Don't take those chances that might cost you a goal on the other end in order to score a goal. Are we once again looking at the Canucks being on the wrong side of the roadmap when it comes to a league-wide style?
Yeah, I'd answer it this way. To me, the NHL of 2016-17 can be described with one word, and that's speed. You have to play fast, and that's both in the offensive and defensive. Now, the interesting thing for me there is Pittsburgh really used their speed to construct the defensive system, which is at the core of their Stanley Cup win last year. So it was back pressure. It was surrounding the puck. It was basically suffocating any offense, but they did it at such tremendous speed. And when they forced turnovers, that's how they created their offense. The Canucks play so slow. And that's so when you're talking about them being on the wrong side of history, that's kind of what I'm seeing here. You've got to be either fast in the offensive end or fast in the defensive end, but you can't be static. And you can't be slow moving. And that to me is the biggest problem facing this team. And yet I look at them and you go, like, Horvat's a pretty good skater. Barrett, pretty good skater. Vertanen, pretty good skater. They've got young legs. You know, they've got some movement in the backhand. I don't know, whatever system it is they've devised just doesn't seem to fit their talent. And then that is the failing of the head coach.
Now, you talked about essentially a scenario where you look at maybe a new coach or a new GM or both come the end of the season. And then where are you? You're looking for a philosophical change again. Sounds an awful lot like the Toronto Maple Leafs up until this year. Mm-hmm. Or maybe up until last year. And I know Babcock is a different guy. He's been there. He has that pedigree. But this is certainly when you talk about the fans and the expectations, a city that's been so used to losing, they have bought into this hope. They've got young players. We know about it. They lucked into a generational talent, so to speak. Is this really what the Canucks have to stare at hard in the mirror and say, we need to do what the Leafs did. We need to, the whole tank thing is stupid. No one deliberately wants to lose, but not worry about results to save your job and just go all in and say, we need to get younger and we need to get more skilled.
Yeah. In a word, yes. I think it's that simple. I think this season has to be about development for the Canucks. I think they have to let go of this fantasy that they're a competitive team and they might make it into the playoffs because we can play defense and we've got good goaltending. Big deal. So let's say that happens. Where are they? And I've kind of gone full circle on this. I kind of bought it a little bit into the line they were spouting a couple of years ago when they did make the playoffs and think, yeah, you know, this is reasonable. Maybe they can pull this off. Not anymore. I mean, to me, Triamkin and Stetcher have to be in the lineup every night. Horvat has to be in, like I said, in that top six role, getting power play time, getting 18 to 19 minutes a night. Same with Vertanen, same with Bear. You've got to know, you've got to find out what you've got in these kids. It's the only way out. It's the only way out. The Sedins, God bless them, aren't going to be around if this thing ever turns around. You've got them to kind of, you know, do the Mander thing, but anybody else in my opinion is, you know, completely tradable. And that's really what they should be looking at. Not just for the sake of making moves, but to create openings for the younger players.
Now, I'm not, you say absolutely yes, that's the way they should go. The elephant in the room, of course, and I don't, you know, I don't want to have to answer these phone calls, but will ownership allow that? Because through all the debacle that you talked about, I'm not pinning it squarely on the ownership, but that's been the constant. Yeah, you've changed the GM, you change the coach, you change the players. The owner's the one who's still been there.
Well, I believe that question will be answered by the turnstiles, by the attendance. And I'm sitting up there, and a lot of nights it looks like the first year I was in Vancouver, which was 98-99, when they were lucky to draw 15,000. And there was just like empty seats all over the place. And it's the same thing in that lower bowl. I just think this market is going to turn that team off. Like, and they're already in the process of it. But I mean, if we're into like game 35 and they're still scoring one goal a game and they're losing, I mean, unless you're trying to sell them hope, and this is what, you know, that's still the aside from winning, it's the best marketing tool in professional sports. That's the only thing you can sell them. But I don't know how they can continue down this path of trying to be competitive because people just aren't buying it anymore.
A quick anecdote there. I talked to someone this week whose family had season tickets from day one in 1970. Over the last few years, his situation had sort of morphed. So he was sharing. He had like a quarter share tickets and everything else, and decided this year not to get them. And his wife kept saying to him, "Do you regret it? Are you sure you didn't want to be at the game? You sure?" He said last week after they were shut out in back-to-back games, he looked at his wife and goes, "How do you feel about having that $800 in your pocket right about now?" And you're absolutely right. I mean, people haven't, some people haven't reached that point yet, but how quickly will they, you know?
Oh, yeah. Well, I've heard variations on that story so many times of people, you know, who were invested in going year after year and season tickets and made a night of going to the Canucks. And they just kind of, there was a fatigue factor, I think, which had set in before they drove the bus off the cliff this year. And I think this is just accelerating it. I look at the BC Lions and, you know, them struggling to get their fans back. You know, how do you bring those fans back?
Yeah.
Once you've lost them, when you're committed to this like long rebuilding process, it's just a mess. It really is.
Speaking of long rebuilding processes, are the Leafs going to be a team that you believe is in contention? I know it's very early, Ed, but you talk about buying into a plan and having those elite pieces. Well, what you see?
Yeah, I do. And no, I don't think the road's going to be particularly short for them. But here's the classic example of a team that can sell hope. And yes, it helps that Austin Matthews is in the lineup. But the other parts, and I know it's a big thing to remove Austin Matthews out of the lineup, but the Leafs are doing it essentially with, you know, players drafted in a similar place to what the Canucks are doing. But, you know, the fans are just, you know, they're not trying to sell this rebuild. You know, they're seeing Matthews grow up in front of them. They're seeing Mitch Marner. They're seeing Morgan Rielly. They're seeing this young core. And there is hope that they will be at the center of something, you know, fairly significant pretty soon. And it's not just the Leafs, though, Paul. This is the other thing. This is the way the NHL is trending. I talk about speed. I mean, the other big identifying feature of the league is youth now. And you can point to like 10 teams that are all going down a path similar to the Canucks, but they're years ahead of the Canucks in terms of their development. And I think a lot of it is because they've committed to playing the kids and committed to playing a system that complements the kids' skills.
You're absolutely right. I mean, this idea that, oh, unless a player is Austin Matthews, you can't burn the first year of the contract sort of restriction by playing in more than 9 games. You know, that was something that was really pervasive around the league. And now you're seeing more teams say, no, we want this guy and we want him to develop faster. I mean, you talk about the Leafs. There's also I struggle to put the Oilers in the same category, one because they got a great player in Connor McDavid, but also because they had so many cracks at it. But it does really look like it's clicked for them this year as well. Montreal is another team that I'm just laughing at, because if there was a coach that was on a hotter seat than Willie Desjardins, it was Michel Therrien. And maybe this is all Carey Price, but you know, after such a horrible offseason and people literally tearing their hair out, I'm looking around Canada and all of a sudden no Canadian teams made the playoffs last year. This is Armageddon for Canadian hockey. As bad as it is in Vancouver, there's some nice stories in Canadian hockey.
Yeah, I think so. I think at the end of the day, well, Montreal will be a playoff team. I think this is the year Edmonton makes the playoffs. there's two right there. And, you know, another one sneaks in. I think the other, like, and we're going to remove the Canucks from the equation, but I think the other three, you can kind of conceive a scenario where if they, you know, get lucky, catch a couple of breaks, they make it too. But
if Ottawa could play the Canucks every night.
but I think it's also telling that three of the more intriguing teams in the league this year are Canadian based, and that's Edmonton, Toronto, and Montreal.
Yeah.
And, you know, they're offering great stories, and I think they will have a following throughout this season.
Speaking of epic losers.
Ah. Good segue. I like what you did there.
Well, you know, it's funny because not to get too personal, I have two daughters. The older daughter, much bigger sports fan than the younger daughter. The younger daughter's more plays, but never really pays attention to it, even the sports that I really care about. So yeah, I've had those fatherly moments sitting with my older daughter, my younger one, sort of like, she'll pretend to be interested for 5 minutes. That game seven captivated her even.
Wow.
Whether, and I think that's when you know, aside from this, baseball's storied past, storytelling elements, curses, whatever have you, as a standalone sporting event, whether you're a baseball fan or not, I don't see how you couldn't get hooked on the drama of that game. We've been sports fans forever, Ed. You've covered a lot of these.
Yeah.
It really, really was. I mean, it was like the Red Sox being down three against the hated Yankees and coming back. Like, it just doesn't happen in a mediocre way when these things happen in baseball.
It's so I really didn't have a dog in the fight this time, although as a sports writer, you find yourself pulling for the story. So I was, you know, inclined toward the Cubs. The most exciting single sporting event I've ever watched by myself in front of a TV was the Buster Douglas Mike Tyson fight. And I remember I was watching, and I can't even remember why. I was either on the road with the Jets or I was at home in Winnipeg, and I was watching, and I was literally standing up on my couch cheering by myself. And it was a little similar watching that game seven. I was just so invested. And my wife, you know, and she is very similar, not a sports fan at all. And I've got to kind of explain the dynamics of her for her, but she was, you know, invested in it too. It was, to me, one of the three, four, or five single, you know, and it's fresh now too. And, you know, you kind of go back and start thinking about things, but I have just never seen a game like that. And then when you start adding the layers, it's game seven of a World Series. It's the Cubs trying to break a 106 game drought. It's the Cleveland Indians trying to break an almost 70 year drought. And then the quality of the game and then the turns and the twists. It was absolutely epic.
Well, yeah. I mean, and if you look at the series as a whole, the Cubs coming back from 3-1, having the lead, obviously their closer blows it. And that to me was, when you talk about teams that, you know, you just said now, I was the same way as you. I prefer the Cubs over the Indians, but you go for the story. But I almost thought the better story would have been the Cubs blew it again. To be up like that. And that, I mean, that two run homer that tied it. You sit there and you look at that and you go, how does a team come back from that? Emotionally, you talk about a gut punch, fighting back from 3-1, having the lead, having the closer who's been so dominant. And then all of a sudden, one swing of the bat and that's it. And I just figured at that point, there was no way they can win. Whether the rain delay played into that or not, it really was as if it was scripted, wasn't it?
I remember tweeted that I started to like reference all the points I thought were turning points of the game. And it started when Chris Bryant slid through the Indians catcher leg, scoring on that shallow fly ball. And I thought, well, that's it. This is the Cubs moment. And then it goes, you know, and then they build the lead. And then that crazy wild pitch where they score who scores two runs on a wild pitch? And I thought that was the moment. Then I thought David Ross's home run was the moment. And then I thought when you go all the way through, and I'm sorry, I want to get this out while it's fresh in my mind. I think Joe Maddon is the luckiest man on the earth. Everybody loves him, and I get all that, but he made moves which were absolutely incomprehensible. And there was at least four that I can think of off the top of my head. Taking out Hendricks as quickly as he did, taking out Lester as quickly as he did, that crazy bunt. When you've got, you know, your slugging second baseman out, who's I believe hit a home run his previous at bat, and then going to Chapman after you burned him the previous two games as quickly as he did, when clearly he's got nothing, for them to win the game despite all that, because Joe Maddon would have been in a place that would have made Grady Little look like Earl Weaver. I was just amazed.
Yeah, no, I heard all that. The funny thing about that is we have seen this in game sevens before. I mean, I was a little surprised Jake Arrieta didn't come out of the pen.
Well, he was warming up. I know. He was ready.
I heard the rationalization from people who follow the Cubs all year that when Hendricks loses it, he loses it quickly. So I think, again, what works for baseball during the regular season, where you can work through things, you can live through a couple of losses. Okay, so a guy's about that, you're learning more about him. It doesn't work in the playoffs. You're absolutely right about Lester. It's like he had in his mind, as soon as one guy gets on base, that's it. The bunt, if the bunt works, then he looks like a genius, but it didn't. So this is it.
If the count is 3-1, then I buy it.
But the one for me,
two strikes, yeah.
The one for me absolutely is Aroldis Chapman. Yeah. 9-2, you don't need to use him the night before. And that to me was the biggest mistake made the night before, because it was, and again, a guy who's used to being dominant, being put in that, and they all know about 108 years and everything else. To be in that situation, I don't know how you can prepare for that. No amount of visualization or confidence in yourself can say, okay, here we go. This is just, I'm just going to throw the ball like I've always thrown it. And then when your body fails you too, that's...
What is he?
And to come back from that, Ed, that's the thing that got me.
Most of the other things kind of make sense if Chapman is fairly rested. Is he any relation, by the way?
I believe it's Cuban, the Cuban channel. They moved there from Liverpool in the 50s, yeah.
If he is healthy and rested, and you've got him for a five-out situation, and you're reasonably confident he's got his 100-mile-an-hour fastball, then the other stuff makes sense. But he had to know. He had stretched him to the limit in games five and six, and maybe you're going to get three outs out of him. But I'm sorry, he brought him in with one out in the eighth, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. And that to me was just putting too much of a strain. What his choices were. Well, God, he had his whole pitching staff available. The other thing is, I mean, they hadn't touched Lester at all. And then, you know, to go and get him when I can't remember, did he walk somebody? Did somebody get a hit? I know there was a runner on when they brought in Chapman.
Yeah, no, that was it.
Because then it goes Guy or Davis. Gave him
a double,
boom,
didn't he?
Boom.
There was someone on second. Anyway, regardless, that's what I mean. He had in his head the slightest hint of trouble. But again, rewind it 24 hours. There's no reason to put your closer in when that game's that well in hand. Mm-hmm. But again, you got to win game six to
and
get
then
to
send
seven.
Him out in the ninth inning.
The week.
Maybe.
Yeah, absolutely.
He got through the meat of the order. That's it. But then to send him out in the ninth made no sense whatsoever.
Yeah.
But anyways, I mean, that's we sound like such sports writers, you know, dissecting this like epic victory that has Bill Murray crying and John Cusack. And I think that was the other great part about the Cubs. I tweeted this out. Not only did they have a cool team, but they had by far the coolest celebrity fan base I think I've ever seen around.
Big upgrade
a team.
On Ben Affleck is what you're saying.
No, well, yeah, the Ben, he was it was Ben Affleck and Stephen King, right? Boston runs a little low. They're all either academics or crime lords in Boston. But yeah, Chicago. How did Eddie Vedder get to be a Cubs fan? By the way,
why don't you like the Mariners?
Well, I know he's not from Seattle originally. Is he kind of a Midwest kid whose family migrated to whatever it is? God bless Bill Murray for, you know, like sitting out in the middle of the stands too, and he was right beside Cusack and right around Theo Epstein.
I thought it was a pretty cool move by Fox. I understand they didn't show this on Sportsnet, but if you were watching Fox sort of after they won, they played a whole bunch of sort of 1970s commercials. I believe Budweiser had queued them up. They were paid ads for Budweiser. They had like Harry Carey in the bleachers in the 70s just the sense of nostalgia. I just thought it was so good. It was, again, you don't have to be a baseball fan. Baseball gets rubbished by a lot of people during the season. That was something else.
Oh, that transcended it. But I mean, to me, that's always going to be the selling point of baseball, is it can tap into this history and tradition like few other sports can. It's funny, when I first really started following baseball seriously, the Cubs were a powerhouse.
Yeah.
In the late 60s, like they had Sando, they had Ernie Banks, they had four Hall of Famers. Fergie Jenkins, and then they had that great 69 team that coughed up a furball against the Mets, and it just seemed like, you know, that's kind of an underrated part of the curse. And, you know, they blew that lead in the black cat walking in front of Sando at Shea Stadium. But that seemed to set that franchise back. That loss seemed to set that franchise back a good couple of decades.
Well, to me, that's one of the things that I really like about the story. And I don't want to say it's not getting enough attention, but, you know, Theo Epstein's plan, if we can go back and sort of tie it in with the Canucks, the 2003 Cubs, who we know the whole Bartman thing, they tried to get that going by throwing money at it, the traditional baseball way, and got in so deep with so many bad contracts and prospects that they traded away to pick up these guys that it took Epstein to come in, and he had a clear mind with it. And no one talked about the Cubs for 6, 7, 8 years that they knew they were clearing the contracts out. They were amassing draft picks. They were going to invest in scouting. And now they're seeing that all come to fruition. And I don't care what sport it is, you know, the youth, the hope, the coming of age, whatever it is, there's something that really does seem to work there when you see that teams that connect. And I'll go back to the Blackhawks again. Yes, they had to suck to get Kane and Taves, but teams that ultimately it can be done. But if you're purely trying to spend your way to a championship, it just doesn't seem to work. Even the Yankees, which are famous for it, had that homegrown core.
Totally. And you're right. Look, you know, there are variations on the theme, but I would say in 90% of the cases, championship teams are built on homegrown talent through the draft, through developing your own players. And then you augment. The only other thing I would say I would on the Paul Chapman's fact checker, that 2003 Cubs team got really unlucky with Mark Pryor and Kerry Wood.
No, 100%. I
mean, they looked like they were going to be like the ultimate 1-2 punch.
No, they were.
Yeah,
and they both burned their arms out that killed their pitching staff. But at the same time, they were going to guys like Ramirez. And Alou, when it started to fall apart, when those guys left, again, they just started throwing huge contracts at everyone and committed so long that they were in salary hell.
The Epstein model, I mean, it's really interesting to me because it's a little unorthodox. And again, we're going to paint with broad strokes here, but it seems to be drafting positional players. And then, you know, when you're at a point where you can go out, then you spend your money on pitching.
Yeah.
In free agency, and he did it to some degree in Boston. He certainly has done it in Chicago. So it's going to be really interesting because the core of that team, like, they should be in a position to win here for the next 5 years to be part of the conversation. So it's going to be interesting to see where they take this thing. I haven't seen a young nucleus like that on a baseball team since, geez, when? You know, look at the players that are 25 under that team.
If you could make an argument, perhaps nowhere near as strong, but it would be with Madden in Tampa Bay. But of course, what happened in Tampa Bay is the players just got picked off left, right, and center.
That's right.
Because I don't think ownership was one willing to commit. But also, that's baseball.
That's right. Well, you don't have to worry about the Cubs being outbid.
No,
right?
Exactly.
Are they still owned by a newspaper, by the way?
No,
that's
not.
An odd one.
Family,
okay.
Yeah. Although I did hear that the Tribune sold out and people were selling their copies for $500, so it is still a permanent record.
For
people
who haven't been to Chicago, it is a spectacular city and just a great sports town. It's got all the artifices of world class cities. It's got art museums. It's got natural history museums. The music scene is unbelievable.
The
live theater, but there is a heart to that city. And that's why I love it. Like when you go to Manhattan is kind of like visiting Disneyland. You're aware everybody who lives there probably makes $1 million and has some crazy job. When you're in Chicago, you're aware people work for a living here.
Yeah.
They get up in the morning, they go to their jobs, then they go to the bar and they watch the game, and then they get up in the morning and do it all over again. But like I said, I've been fortunate enough to go to Chicago numerous times over the years, and it's one of my favorite American cities.
One of my favorites, too. And I find their sports scene so intriguing because the 85 Bears flamed out so quickly, but really are an NFL all-time team. Then, of course, you had Michael Jordan and the Bulls. But all these other franchises, which had such an epic record of losing, now the Blackhawks broke that a few years ago, you know, because the Blackhawks were honestly terrible for since Stan Mikita, to be honest with you. I know they made the finals with Roenick once, but Mario Lemieux took care of that quickly. And Blackhawks played themselves into a period of dominance. The White Sox broke their streak, and now you got the Cubs. So, you know, whereas they used to maybe hold up the exalted 85 Bears as their beacon of hope, they've had it all now, too, really. It's
All they need
is Northwestern, actually.
They really have flipped it. So what's the biggest loser city left now?
Can't even say Cleveland.
Well, that's what I was kind of building on. You can't say Cleveland. Toronto, not bad. And it's funny because I remember colleague Steve Simmons writing a column about this being a golden era of Toronto sports, because you had the Blue Jays winning a playoff series, you had the Raptors winning a playoff series, you had Toronto FC winning a playoff series and still alive, and now you have Auston Matthews. Well, considering their last championship was 93, but the Leafs going back to 67.
But that was the issue with the Leafs, is they hadn't, none of those teams had even made the playoffs for so long, right? But you're right. To see it all come together for a franchise like the Cubs now turns the attention somewhere else, and now it's Cleveland, right? But it was a great story. It's been a good year in sports. I'll say this as well. One trope I just do not want to see anymore is the loser who gets the tattoo of his team champion before the event is over, and then everyone laughs at him afterwards. I started seeing this about 4 years ago, you know, when the Broncos were playing the Seahawks, the guy with the Broncos world champion. So there's a guy that was he went out the day of game 7 and he had a Cleveland Cavaliers world champions tattoo, and he put the Cleveland Indians world series tattoo on that. And then of course, everyone, he hasn't tweeted since the sixth inning type thing. I've seen it enough. Now don't go out and get any tattoos until your team actually wins a championship. And even then I'd say maybe.
See, I think that is the lasting lesson to be derived from all this pretty clearly. I think there's one immutable lesson to learn from all this. It is.
All right, Ed, we'll close it up here in a second. Just quickly, what are you most looking forward to this weekend?
I'm honestly looking to the Lions, and not so much what they do in the game, but it's the reaction of the market, and it looks like they're going to get about 25,000, which in years past would have meant nothing, but it'll be by far the biggest crowd of the year. Saskatchewan's now, but they can really set the table for the Western semifinal with the good performance here. And it's been an astonishing year. When I think of the games, I have to go back to that 2004 season where crazy Casey Printers came in and started throwing for 400 yards a game for excitement on a night in, night out basis. The games have really been terrific and provided, you know, terrific entertainment value. And I'm not here shilling for the Lions. That really is like kind of you just have to look at the score. So they just messed the sheets, the one game against Calgary. So that to me is what I'm looking forward
That's
to.
That's great. And
maybe the Canucks will score a goal.
Yeah. Well, then we'll have to have a parade, won't we?
Yes.
We'll be back next week. On that point quickly though, maybe we probably won't get to it next week because there's so much else going on, but just as you mentioned the Lions, you know, there's been all this debate, Lions versus Whitecaps, Lions. I think it's super telling for the Whitecaps how far off the radar the MLS playoffs are. Honestly, as soon as the Whitecaps season is over, I bet you I could go out and find 10 sports fans on the street who couldn't tell you the teams that are left.
Yep.
And that's a problem for the Whitecaps to tackle going forward. Yes, you've got a great sports experience. Yes, you're getting people in tune with your team, but you have to care about the rest of the league even a little bit and who wins the championship to pay attention to it. So there we go. All right, Ed, thanks for your time. Thanks for listening, everyone. We will be back with you next week.